Now, as we start here in the 17th, 18th verses this morning, we're going to find Paul, he's on board ship. He has left the island of Crete, and we're going to be counting days, one day, 2 days, 3 days, and then somewhere a little later on, we're going to count 14 days. So we'll be looking at that as we go this morning. But I want to go back, and I want us to do some thinking before we get into this. And I want you to think about the environment on board ship. And the first part of the environment on board ship I want you to think about, I want you to think about the social structure on board ship. Those who are on board this ship, the kind of people that Paul's on ship with, where he fits in these people that are on board this ship. Now, as we think about that, we're going to be thinking about people from all different types of lifestyles. So what are we going to think about as we contemplate these people on board this ship, who are on board this ship? All right, you got soldiers. They come from Rome, so these are Roman soldiers out of a Latin background. And probably as them being Roman soldiers, what kind of religious beliefs are they? Idols, paganism. So you've got these Roman soldiers come out of paganism. Actually, they developed out of Greek paganism that was 200 or 300 years before, and they came out of that Greek paganism and accepted that and built their various temples until they finally had one temple to all the idolatrous gods. So you've got those people on board. Who else is Paul traveling with? He's traveling with prisoners. He is a prisoner of Rome. There's other prisoners. We notice the term prisoners used in the plural, don't we? Now, as these people are prisoners of Rome, what kind of people would these be? All right. So you're looking at, and most of them would be criminals. There might be anything from a thief to a murderer on board. And these are the people that he's most directly in contact with because he's a prisoner. All right, well, who else do you see on board? You see the crew. Now, where is this ship from? Alexandria, Egypt. So, coming out of Egypt, what probably is the makeup of this crew? Egyptian. And the Egyptians, God-wise, were what? Idolaters, pagans. Remember all of the 10 plagues upon Egypt. Each one of them hit at a different Egyptian god. So Egypt has many gods. And so this crew is probably made up of individuals that believe in a variety of gods. Now, they probably would accept Paul's God as one of the gods, but not as the true one God of heaven. So these are on board. Anybody else on board? All right. Okay, he's got Luke, Paul's companion, and Aristarchus is on board. So you've got Paul traveling at least with two others that are Christians. All right, somebody say something else? Okay, so you've got a very small contingency probably of Christians here among a whole host of pagans. All right, now that's the religious look. Let's go on and consider the social list a little bit more. Socially, where does Paul fit in with this group? There are all these that are traveling on board his ship. How many people are on this ship? 200. That's right, Keith. 276 people are on board this ship. So, with 276 people, you've got some type of social structure on board this ship. Where does Paul fit in this social structure? Well, first of all, you've got the commandant of the ship or the owner of the ship. We know he's on board. Secondly, you've got the individuals that work for him. So, you've got the laborers on board the ship. Who else is on board that ship in this social structure? You got the soldiers that we've mentioned on board the ship, and they fit in this social structure. Matter of fact is, their placement in this social structure actually changes during the events of this travel. Who else is on this ship? As far as the social structure of it. You've got passengers, individuals that paid to ride this ship. We know that's the case. So you've got individuals that are passengers. They've hired a place on this ship for their travel. Anyone else? You got prisoners on this ship. Now that Paul is on this ship, not as a passenger, he's on this ship as a prisoner. And as a prisoner, he is in the very bottom social group on board this ship. He's below the servants. The servants on board the ship are either riding with paid passengers or serving the crew of the ship. And so he's below all of that. Actually, the prisoners on board this ship are at the very lowest level on board the ship. Now, that's going to show us some things as we study this morning and as we see some of the actions that are taken on board this ship. But we need to remember that Paul is not in a position. Matter of fact, is when he said, don't leave the island of Crete, he was speaking as at the very bottom rung on the social level. And you know what often gets done to the people on the very bottom rung of the social level? They get ignored. That's right. You don't listen to them even when they have wisdom. Oh, by the way, where did Jesus fit in his social level of his day? Huh? Oh, let's expose it. Where did Jesus fit in the social level of his day? They didn't want him. They crucified him. Where did he fit in the social level? Huh? Why? He's right. He's at the bottom. But why? All right, they born in poverty. Why? There's other reasons why he was really at the bottom. What? Nazarite, from Nazareth, you know, can anything good come out of Nazareth? Remember that? Why was he at the bottom? Now, he did turn the world upside down, and he turned the social level upside down too. But there's another key reason he was at the bottom. Huh? He's a carpenter's son. He's out of the trades, and then that didn't put him very high on it. Any other reason? He put himself, that's right, he placed himself as a servant. He was the servant of all servants because of his will. But there's still another perception of man that put him down at the bottom. Well, he was different. He fought the Jewish establishment, that's right. That's true. They didn't perceive his authority. Yeah, he was, but now there's a human perception that placed him at the very bottom. Perceive what? Okay, and what was the concept in the mind of Jesus? And so they perceived him to be illegitimate. And in that day and time, that put the individual in the physical sense on the very, very bottom. Because they had no legal rights. They had no right of heirship. They had no right of family. And so Jesus dealt with this very same thing. And I mean, in his life, he had to fight this whole social stigma to overcome it, to do what God sent him here to do. You know, sometimes Christian brethren can be guilty of putting people in a social stigma. Somebody look at me and say, preacher, how can you even say such a thing? Because of James chapter 2. Sometimes Christian people will say to some people, sit thou here, and other people, sit thou there. We need to be careful. Our placement socially is not a spiritual placement. And a lot of times what the world perceives as social placement is an unrighteous placement of individuals. So we need to be very careful. Paul is pictured at the very bottom of the social level on this ship. But he carries the wisdom, because God's given it to him, he carries the wisdom to save everybody on board this ship alive. And that's what we're going to see as we study this morning. Okay, so verse 17, they take it up. They had to undergird the ship. They tied the ship together. We talked about this process. Verse 18, and we being exceedingly tossed with a tempest, the next day they lightened the ship. Now, if we're studying days here, in verse 18, that's the second day out of Crete. The first day after they left the island, they tied the ship together because the storm was so great. The second day, he describes it here as the aspect of being exceedingly tossed. Anybody ever traveled on sea? Anybody ever traveled in a big boat out on the ocean? Get sick? And what did they do when they got sick? Okay. And you know, in our day and time, we think of things, you know, where people have stuff to clean that up. But go back all of these years. They're exceedingly tossed. This is no calm sea that they're traveling in. Remember, if they've had to tie the ship together to keep it from breaking apart, it's rough, really rough. And so that being the case, you've got on board this ship, you've got people that are sick. Now, I've read stories about, especially through the early American times and the shipping that came in and out of America, and that at some times people would be so sick that the whole ship would just be filled with filth, where people had been sick because of the tossing at sea. And that's probably kind of picture that you get here. Now, put that together with this. 14 days from now, Paul is going to encourage them to do what? Huh? Yeah, but as he talks to them about that, he says to them, because they have not eaten to take food. Why haven't they eaten? Sick, because this violent storm at sea going on for all of these days. And you know, mostly they didn't feel like eating. They worked, they were worried, they had a lot of things opposed to them. That's the picture. I mean, it's almost impossible. It's impossible to sit down in any ordinary way, and plus when you do, a lot of times it's impossible to keep down that which you've eaten. So this is what's going on board this ship. But on this second day, it says they lightened the ship. What does it mean, lightened? They threw something over. Okay. I'm going to submit to you it wasn't the cargo at this point. No, I don't think it's people. Now there was a time that there was a storm at sea that they threw people over, a person overboard, in Jonah's case. And there's some similarities between this story and Jonah's case, but I don't think it's people at this point. I do not believe that it is the cargo. They're going to come down and throw the tackling of the ship overboard in a little while. I don't think it's that yet. Ah, they threw over things that were totally unnecessary. Cargo was necessary. The ship owner, he had to get the cargo to port to get paid. The ship's tackling still necessary. They need to keep that as long as they can. But at this point, they throw overboard anything that's not necessary. You know, grandma's traveling with her trunk. And, you know, I'm giving you a modern-day picture of this. And her trunk's just, that trunk goes overboard. They throw anything that's not necessary overboard. Probably a lot of the luggage that the paid traveler has brought with him goes overboard at this point. He can get clothes somewhere else. He can't get a life somewhere else. Those clothing and that stuff is less important than the food stuff, the cargo, and the ship's tackle. And so here on this second day, they do this. The third day, verse 19. And the third day we cast out with our own hands the tackling of the ship. Now, the third day comes, the storm is still going. You've got to make choices. Now, they didn't throw all the tackling of the ship out. How do we know that? Ah, they still not only had one anchor, they had at least four anchors. They put four anchors out at the stern about 13 days from this time. So we know they had at least anchors left. Anything else? When they got ready to go toward Malta, what did they do? What did they put up? Huh? The mainsail. So they throw over tackling. They don't throw over all of it. They still got a small boat on here because they're going to use it later. And so when it says they threw out the tackling of the ship, they were selective. Don't you know that that ship's master was up there telling them specifically what to keep and what to throw overboard? He was the most qualified individual on board that ship to know what they had to keep. And so there was a selection going on here on this day of what to throw overboard and what to keep. Now, in this text, in the third day we cast out with our own hands the tackling of the ship. That tells us something interesting. Who's the we? Well, the prisoner, but since it uses we here, who's writing? Luke's writing the text, so Luke and probably Paul, too, have assisted, since he uses we, assisted in throwing overboard the tackling. Probably. In other words, the commander of the ship has, and you know the chief captain, the centurion might have had something to do with this, too. He might have ordered the prisoners to get involved in this. But it shows us that others were involved in it. It took a lot of manpower to do what needed to be done, and they solicited the manpower. This is not just the crew of the ship throwing a few items overboard. This is with a lot of people involved in it, getting some heavy items, getting them overboard, getting them off. Why do they want these items off the ship? Okay, but how does that help them live? All right, lightens the ship so that the ship's not sitting down as far in the water. If the ship's lighter, it floats up more, and it's harder, more difficult for the wave to overcome the ship and fill it. And so that's why they're trying to get this off. This tells us also about how bad this storm is. All right, verse 20. And when neither sun nor stars in many days appeared, no small tempest lay upon us, all hope that we should be saved was taken away. I find this an interesting verse because of the phrase many days. What does many days involve? It's more than three. They've gone 3 days and then they go many more days. Now, out here in a little while, he's going to designate the 14th day. So we know that many days is more than the three that they've already had, but not any more than 14. Get your mindset. Friends, if you're on that ship, it's bobbing up and down like a cork. Waves are coming over it. The wind's blowing against it. There were some long days. And if the days weren't long enough, what about the nights? What did those people, when they looked off that ship at night, what did they see? Huh? Well, let's think a minute. No stars, no moon. Did they see where the spotlight hit out there? You reckon they had the spotlight scan in the horizon? No spotlight. They were in darkness at night. They couldn't see. Terrible black darkness. Now, there might have been some type of difference in contrast between the sea and the sky, but mostly it's not like we perceive it. They couldn't look and hope for land and see a beacon on land or a tower on land, that searchlight going around. That wasn't going to happen. They were in total darkness. And you talk about long days and long nights, and you can see why Paul uses this phrase here, after many days. They're tossed at sea, the long nights, they can't eat and keep it down. It just drags on and on and on. And can you imagine going through this for 14 days? 2 weeks of it. I can't imagine. I try. And I think it's good for us to try to imagine, try to put ourselves in, because that's the environment that these things are happening in. Okay. So they cast out the tackle and the ship. And when neither sun nor stars in many days appeared, no small tempest leapt on us, all hope that we should be saved was taken away. Then he introduces their mindset. What was their thinking? Because what could they do? Can you fight the wind? Can you fight the waves? What can you do in the middle of the ocean if the ocean decides to swallow you up? Huh? Yeah, they don't even know where they are. So he presents this as a totally hopeless situation. All right, verse, where are we at, 21? Okay, but after long abstinence, Paul stood forth in the midst of them and said, "Sirs, ye should have hearkened to me and have not loosed from Crete to have gained this harm and loss." You know, Paul almost gets "I told you so" in here, doesn't he? Now, he's got a purpose. I don't believe Paul's just bragging to them here. Why does he bring this fact up that he told them not to leave Crete? And so he's reminding them of something that he prophesied about. He's talking about the fulfillment of it, trying to get them to believe. You know, that was the purpose of prophecy. Now, I don't know if you've ever thought about it or not, but on this trip, Paul prophesied several times about things that are going to shortly happen. We don't usually think of Paul as a prophet, do we? We think of him as an apostle. We think of him as a prisoner. We think of him as... He was a prophet. What allowed him to prophesy? Inspiration. God told him. And so here Paul comes out and he's telling them this, trying to get them to think, because this is going to play an important role later on. If he can make them see that he prophesied the demise of the ship, later on when God tells him something else, he might get them to believe it before it's too late. You know, we might have done, you know, sometimes we might do the same thing. Not that we prophesy, but we might do the same thing and say, "I told you so," because we want to be rectified ourselves. That's not Paul's purpose here, again. Okay, so he told them if they'd listen to him. Verse 22, "And now I exhort you to be of good cheer, for there shall be no loss of any man's life among you but the ship." Now he said, here was my earlier prophecy. Here's what happened. He said, now let me give you another prophecy. And what's his prophecy here? You're not going to die. I don't know how public Paul made this statement, but if he made this statement on the board ship where others could hear, his statement was, you're not going to die. Second part of the prophecy, what was it? You're going to lose the ship. Now, as he makes this prophecy is good news. What is the most valuable commodity on that ship? Life. People's lives. Paul has said that is valued most is going to be saved. Everything else is going to be lost. Now, he has set the groundwork for what's going to come at them from the future. And yet, I'm not sure that they're all convinced to listen to Paul at this point. But nevertheless, he tells them that that's what's going to happen. Now, he's going to tell them why. Verse 23. "For there stood by me this night, the angel of God, whose I am and whom I serve. How does he know this? An angel of God. God told him. Actually, this is a statement of revelation. God revealed the facts to him of what was going to take place. Now, got to put this in the mindset of the people he's traveling with. How many is he traveling with that we know of that believe in Christ and believe in God? Two others. How many is he traveling with believe in multiplicity of gods? All the rest of them. And in their belief of their multiplicity of gods, if their gods tell them something, what happens? Yeah, they can't speak, start with. So first of all, there's no... So this idea that an angel of God is sent to Paul to tell him what to say is strange to the most of them. Now, they in their paganism might believe past false accounts of gods falling down from heaven. You remember any accounts like that recorded in the New Testament? Yeah, Jupiter and Barnabas was Mercury, and that came from a story about the gods there of Laodicean gods who fell down from heaven, and that, you know. So they believe all kinds of things like that. But what Paul is telling them here is very strange to them and their religious beliefs. Now, the interesting thing is, Paul is setting the foundation to bring them to believe in the one true God of heaven. He is beginning to reveal to them evidences. And by the way, brethren, we believe because of evidences. Yes, it does introduce himself as God's servant. But the main thing he's trying to get them to see is the evidences for God. Do you believe what you believe? Because of family? Because of tradition? Or do you believe what you believe because of the evidences of truth? Brethren, we are in a state of weakened condition inside the church because we have failed to study, to ascertain, and to believe because of the evidences, the proofs that are given. The New Testament itself is a witnessed testimony to Jesus Christ. We'll talk more about that later today. But here Paul presents himself as the spokesman for God. God's telling him these things, and he's trying to convince them to start listening to him because of the evidences. And he evidences that God has come to him, this angel of God has come to him and told him these things. Now here's what the angel said, saying, "Fear not." Did you know that is the most common first statement of an angel or the angels that are recorded in the entirety of the Bible? The majority of the angels, when they come, the first thing they say to the individual is, "Fear not." Why does an angel say that? Right, if you hadn't seen them before, you become afraid. Now, Paul's seen angels before, had he not? And the angel saying, "Fear not," to Paul here, maybe for a little different reason, but the angels usually say, "Fear not," trying to calm the individual so the individual will understand what the angel has to say to them. You know, that tells us a little bit that when an angel appeared to these individuals, the angel appeared in a glory that was fearsome. They had to tell the people not to fear. It appeared in a glory that was outside of the physical realm. It appeared in a glory that was tied to the spiritual. An angel is not a physical being. An angel that, as Paul mentions about here, is a spiritual messenger. A spiritual messenger that is sent by God. It does not have the same presence that a physical being, that a man does. Now, there were occasions that God's messengers came and appeared as men, such as Abraham in the plains of Mamre. But in this case, it is a spiritual being that comes and appears before Paul. Now, as he says this statement to Paul, fear not, he's telling Paul not to fear about the things that's going to happen to him. Fear not, thou must be brought before Caesar, and lo, God has given thee all them that sail with thee. God gives Paul a guarantee. Let's talk about guarantees. Tell me God's guarantee for you. And so if I'll be faithful till death, I'll get a crown of life. If I'll live unrighteously, I'll pay the wages of sin, eternal condemnation. I've got a guarantee. I've got an absolute that God gives me. Now, a lot of people are going through the world, and as they go through the world, they think that there's nothing guaranteed. There's no absolute. Matter of fact, is you know what makes us think that way? It's because the things that we take as guarantees are no guarantees at all. Health. My friends, we're not any of us guaranteed health. In my time in preaching, I've been around enough people that were well one day and on the breaks your heart. Well one day in good health and sitting on the deathbed by them the next day. And no guarantees in hell. Wealth, just we'll go down the list. Sometimes we get well off. We think, well, we've got it made because look at our houses and look at our cars and look at our bank accounts and look at our clothing and look at all the trinkets and toys that we have. And all that can be gone tomorrow. My friends, in the last 2 years of financial reversals, do you have any imagination the millions of people in this nation alone that no longer have a house to live in because they could no longer make the payment? That's what happens to wealth. Maybe God's trying to wake us up to reality. Huh? Greed gets involved in it. That's true. Health is not certain. Wealth is not certain. Life. Let's just cut to the chase. Is a vapor that appeareth a little time and then, and let me tell you, it's vanishing. It's fading away. Not a soul in this auditorium that's not older today than you were yesterday. Friends, we've been together about 5.5 years, and in 5.5 years, a lot of us have changed. Temporary. You have a certainty. Latch on to it. Believe it. Work for it. Live it. And get all the junk out of the way that is uncertain. Paul comes here, or the angel of God comes here to Paul, and he gives Paul a certainty. And that certainty is, Paul, you're going to survive. You're going to go to Caesar. You're going to be at Rome. And everybody on this ship is going to live with you also. Now, how many days have we been out to sea? Many. What's going on all those days? Uncertainty, storm, great storm, until all what was lost? All hope was lost, and God comes along and says, I'll give you hope. You know, in life, sometimes there's a lot of storms. You ever tire of the storms of life, and sometimes it seems like the storms of life have gone many days, full of troubles? By the way, Job says that. You know, there's still hope. Eternal hope. Romans 8, 23 and 24. Paul talked about that hope. And we can possess that hope. Verse 24, we're saved by hope. Hope that is seen is not hope. For what a man seeth, why yet does he hope for? Take the certainty of hope and live with it. Grow with it. Mature with it in your Christian life. Okay, so Paul was given this hope as he has talked to this angel, and he takes this hope that God has given to him and says, wherefore, sirs, be of good cheer, for I believe God that it shall be even as it was told me. Paul goes out and tells him, does he take credit for this knowledge? No. God gave this knowledge. Did Joseph take credit when he told the dreams of Pharaoh? No, he said, God alone can interpret the dreams. And so here Paul does the same thing. Paul says, this is not of me, this is of God. God has told us that this is the way it will be. And it says, be of good cheer. What does he mean, be of good cheer here? Huh? Have hope. What have they had for all these days? No hope. Lost. And he says, cheer up. Do we ever need just to cheer up? My friend, sometimes I think Christian people have become the most depressed people there are on the face of the earth. Because you know why? We look at things that are uncertain instead of the things that are certain. We look at the things going on in our world. We look at the things going on in our government. We look at things going on in our financial base. Instead of looking at things of God. And so Paul here, as he looked at these things, he could tell these individuals to take hope. He could tell them to look forward, to get up out of the depression, the being down that they were in, this loss of hope. We're going to be saved. Verse 25, wherefore, sirs, 26, we must be cast upon a certain island. He tell them what's going to happen. But when the 14th night was come, there's our timeline. 14th night from when? From when the storm started. When did the storm start? Yeah, I know, 14 days ago, Bob. It started the day they did what? They left harbor. The day they left Crete, the storm started. And so that's been 14 days since they left that harbor. 14 days since they saw the sun, moon, and the stars. 14 days of tossing and turning on the sea. All right, we were driven up and down in Adria. About midnight, the shipmen deemed that they drew near to some country. And so here he talks about Adria, the Adriatic Sea. It's the sea that's between Italy and Greece. On our maps, it's pictured as that body of water that sits there between the boot of Italy and the mainland and Greece and all. But if you come right down from that and go south all the way to Africa, in Paul's day, all of that was called the Adriatic Sea. And so we don't know where where all they had gone in that time. We know where the island of Malta or Miletus is, and so we know where they end up. We don't know the path by which they took to get there. They didn't know the path by which they took to get there. They had no way to navigate. You can't see the stars, you can't see the moon, you can't see the sun, you can't navigate. Now, in their day and time, they could navigate seeing those things. They could not navigate without those things. Okay, so anyway, they're going to be cast up on this island, and the 14th day they're in Adria, and they deem that they draw near to some country. They sounded. What does that mean? All right. That's again a nautical term. Paul, by the way, uses several nautical terms in here. Is he qualified to use nautical terms? Well, now, wait a minute. How many times has he been shipwrecked? And what is it? How has he traveled on every missionary journey? Well, shit. I don't know that he is a seaman, but just simply by the number of hours that he has spent on ship, he has understood certain things. Anyway, they sounded. They took the depth. Found it 15 fathoms. What's a fathom? Got to know. We're going to know how deep this is. It's Luke writing it, yeah. Telling the case. They found 15 fathoms. How deep is it? What's a fathom? All right. 15 feet deep then? Huh? A fathom in that day and time was from the tip of the finger to the tip of the finger. Okay? So you're talking about what? 5 or 6 foot for a fathom, 15 fathoms? Huh? Yeah, I think if you multiply it by 6, you come out with 90, don't you? 90 times, it's about 90 or less. So somewhere around 90 feet. Boy, it seems like an awful deep area then, doesn't it? Yeah, and the ships are old, heavy ships are made of wood that's loaded. It's probably riding deep in the water. And so just because it says it's 15 fathoms deep, that doesn't mean they've got all of that distance, see. You've got to count from where the bottom of the ship is riding. Okay, and then fearing lest we should have fallen upon rocks, they cast 4 anchors out of the stern and wished for day. And so when they found that this fathoms, the depth was getting less and less, they put out the anchors. So they put the anchors out of which part of the ship? What? What's the stern? Back. All right, so they put the anchors out the back of the ship. Why 4 anchors? What they had? The 4 anchors show you the intensity of the storm. They're trying to stabilize it. 1 anchor would not hold it. They put 4 anchors out trying to hold the ship. They want to hold the ship in that position until daylight. That means the anchors are thrown out the back. The storm's pushing the ship forward. And the only thing that's holding it is the anchors being stuck in the bottom. And they're trying to hold the ship to keep it from going in on the rocks. Okay, Paul said to the centurion, the soldier, I said, let me back up 30. And as the shipmen were about to flee out of the ship, they had to let down the boat in the sea under color as though they would have cast anchors out of the foreship. Now, your shipmen, your crew, they're about to do what? Desert ship. They're about to leave. But they do it deceitfully. What are they doing? What do they pretend to do? They're going to work on it. They're going to go and put anchors on the front of the ship as their pretense. They're letting the little boat down. By the way, that's a term that means a skiff or a small boat, a boat that's carried on board of the sailor. They're letting the little boat down. They're getting on board it as if they're going to put out anchors in the front of the ship. But instead, their intent is to do what? Leave. They're going to leave everybody else. They're going to desert the people on the ship. That's the situation. We'll pick up there and maybe finish this next time.